The title of my lecture this morning was assigned to me by a program committee planning the upcoming biennial convention of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, Judaism in a Secular Age. It's not the kind of title that, as you know, I prefer. I pride myself on being a little more specific and a little more imaginative. It reminds me of nothing more than the title that my father used to use whenever he didn't know quite what he was going to speak about the following week. And he would announce the title, Opening Windows on Life. And through that open window, you'd be surprised what could come. The Union of American Hebrew Congregations is, as you know, the national body of liberal and reform congregations on this continent. They're going to be meeting the middle of this month in San Francisco. Most of these conferences deal with institutional matters, with financial matters, with a display of the various projects and activities of the national body and of the individual congregations. But traditionally, one portion of the program is given over to what they call Torah, which is really not a study of sacred texts, but simply an attempt to come to grips with some set of ideas, of concerns, of attitudes, which are significant in the unfolding of our liberal religious, Jewish religious tradition. They chose this year to center the Torah section on a centenary perspective, which was published a year ago by the rabbinic body, the Central Conference of American Rabbis. This perspective purports to draw together the themes of our current concerns, our commitments, as they exist at this moment in time, and they thought that going through this document, taking major theses from within it, would be of interest to everyone. Now, if you ask me why I have never heard of the centenary perspective of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, it's because I've never chosen to talk to you about it. The publication of this document is one of the great non-events of recent history. But more of that anon. What I would like to do is to tell you a little bit about what I am going to say, not so much to give you a preview of it, but simply to suggest to you why I'm going to say what I'm going to say. After it's all over, maybe I'll rehearse it for you and tell you something about the reactions to it. But essentially what these program planners did was to choose five theses from within this perspective: God, Torah, the people Israel, religious practice, and Jewish identity. And assign one of these topics to five of us. I was assigned the topic of Jewish identity, which is simply the shorthand term which describes how it is that we will produce another generation of Jews, what it is that we define as being Jewish, what is the identity a Jew has which makes it different than simply a garden variety human being. And because I think that the perspective of what I'm going to say raises one of perhaps the critical problem facing liberal Jewish life in America, the world, perhaps the background would be more interest to you than the text itself, which in any case will be published. Our great problem, I would suggest, is the problem of delineation, of definition. Liberal Judaism likes to consider itself as essentially a concern with taking the old familiar body of Judaism, the essence of Judaism, and clothing it in the new mode. Obviously, cultural styles change, the same way dress styles change. And obviously, there's a value of taking the central themes of any religious tradition and clothing them in a way which will seem attractive to the eye, to the spirit, to the mind of a new generation, one conditioned by these new sets of cultural values. Now, this seems to be a laudable undertaking, but it's far more difficult in practice than in the statement. In the first place, Judaism is a long-lived and rich religious civilization. And the minute you begin to abstract a certain essence from the richness and the variety, the living texture of the tradition, you denature it, you reduce it, you begin to transform it into something which in fact it isn't. One ought to be able to define the essence of Judaism, And any number of fine 19th and 20th century Jewish theologians have tried to do it. But in practice, it's very difficult to do, because the very variety of the tradition is part of its life, part of its vitality. And the minute you reduce it, you synthesize it, you turn it into some abstract concepts which are no longer essentially Jewish. They have value in themselves, but they somehow are no longer tied to the living tradition. And then the other side of the coin, though it was an understandable undertaking in Hellenistic times, or in Islamic times, or during the Age of Faith, the Middle Ages in Europe, though it was an understandable undertaking to try and to see the basic context and configuration of the outside culture, and to choose those things in that culture which seemed valid and useful and successful, and weave them somehow into the Jewish context. Our modern culture differs from all of these by its very convulsiveness, by the fact it is not a single thing, it is not a coherent entity. There are many cultures, many isms, many sets of values out there. Which shall we adjust Judaism to? What dress shall we adopt as being in style? It's a difficult question. And because we live in such a sizzling cultural world, it's one which has presented, obviously, many, many difficulties for us. So the process of adjusting Judaism, the ancient faith, to the modern world has been a very difficult one. And from time to time, our liberal religious body has found it useful to essentially take stock, to present a state of the faith document. The first such document was prepared in 1885. It was prepared by the Central Conference of American Rabbis about 10 years after it was formed. It was a very small body of people at the time. And it presented the state of liberal Judaism at the end of the 19th century. As you would imagine, it reflects the attitudes, the values, the optimism of that period in our history. These rabbis, American Jews then at the time, felt themselves very much a part of a new world, of a new experience. They felt that liberal democracy, that open-mindedness, that human brotherhood, the concept of humanity, were part of the wave of the future. And this document attempts to suggest the ways in which we are like, not the ways in which we are distinct. The whole drive is to position Judaism as part of Western civilization. Judaism is called ethical monotheism, the faith in the one God whose basic, and the basic responsibility of the faithful is to social action, is to citizenship, is to commitment to the common weal. Those things which are special, custom, the Sabbath, the holidays, ritual, are declared to be interesting, colorful, but not essential. The test of the Jew is the kind of citizen that he becomes. And as ethical monotheism, Judaism can be seen as a religious community, one of many religious communities ultimately founded on the very same principle of faith in the one God and ethical and moral concern. And the ties which we have with our neighbors are, in a sense, strengthened. And at this moment in time, though, the very first shiploads of young chalutzim from southern Russia were just about ready to set out for Palestine, and they numbered, perhaps in 1885, less than 1,000. Those who drew up this document were very much concerned about the sense of establishing a Jewish national home, because they felt that belonging, being citizens of a state here in the United States, in Canada, wherever they happened to find themselves, was the wave of the future. That to set ourselves apart was something regressive, recidivist, of which they wanted no part. And so as one of the documents of this plank, they wrote, "We considered ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore do not expect to return to Palestine." It's a doctrine of belongingness, of ties, of the ties that bind the Jew to the man of goodwill, the person of goodwill, all who share the world with us. 50 years later, in 1937, the Central Conference of American Rabbis published another platform. A generation, a little bit more, had passed, and the world had changed. And whereas in 1885, America, democracy, freedom, humanity, social justice seemed the wave of the future, in 1937, fascism, tyranny was in the saddle. Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler. 13 years before, the United States had gone back on its own traditions by passing a series of racist immigration laws. 6 years before, the Great Britain had begun to stamp down Jewish immigration, though not Arab immigration, into Palestine. The first of the white papers had been published. America was not simply now the great hope of a brotherhood of men of goodwill, but out there were Father Coughlin and the Klan and the Dearborn Independent and the German-American Bund. The times had changed. It was clearly a moment in which Jews had to go back into their own tradition and find encouragement within it against the shadows. So in this new document, the religious tradition is emphasized, the Sabbath, the holidays, the spoken Hebrew, the things that are distinctive about Jewish life, which gives us a sense of history, of worth, of high culture, of having a set of values of our own which are significant. And in this tradition, no one was any longer interested simply in assimilation, in becoming one with and all the things that we shared, although common concerns were talked about. But now they went ahead and said and talked about the obligation of all Jewry to aid in the upbuilding of Palestine as a Jewish homeland, not only as a haven of refuge for the oppressed, but as a center of Jewish culture and spiritual life. Much had changed, and these documents reflect the changing times. Now, the first document was passed in Pittsburgh in 1885, and it came to be called as the Pittsburgh Platform, and this other document was passed in 1937 in Columbus, in Ohio, and became to call the Columbus Platform. And about 4 years ago, after all, another generation had passed, it became evident that it would be an appropriate time to rethink the positions of liberal Judaism, the emphases that we wanted to give to our tradition at this moment in time. And since the 100th anniversary of the Central Conference of American Rabbis was to take place in 1976, it was decided to appoint a platform committee who would bring in a new state of the faith document for consideration for presentation at that time. This group was appointed in 1974. They met, learned papers were written, paragraphs were written, paragraphs were criticized, paragraphs were written again. And after 2 years of meetings, the platform committee returned to the board of the Central Conference of American Rabbis and announced they could not produce a platform, that there were irreconcilable differences between them, and that they were unable to come up with a single document. Now, what were these irreconcilable differences? Well, if you look at them objectively, they weren't irreconcilable at all. Some were concerned and applauded the reintroduction of all kinds of traditionally Jewish customs and ceremonies in our practice. Others saw this as a return to tradition, to orthodoxy, and as a turning away from the social mission which they felt was at the very heart of our religious tradition. Some were interested in writing into this document a series of statements of concern for the special needs of Jews around the world. There were a new set of concerns as America seemed to be breaking down into ethnic groups and racial groups, that the Jews not be ridden out of consideration. And others looked upon any concern with affirmative action or programs of this kind as regressive and parochial, as standing in the way of our larger interests. We ought to be concerned only with the larger goals. And finally, there was a group which wanted to deepen and emphasize the commitment to Israel, beleaguered as it is in the Middle East after four Arab wars, and others who felt that Israel was assuming too much of a place of centrality in Jewish concerns, that too much of our energy, our time, of our money was involved in the succor of Israel, and that more of this ought to be placed to the needs of our own diaspora communities here in the United States, in Canada and elsewhere. Now, I do not consider these differences to be beyond accommodation. I do know that both of the original documents in 1885 and 1937 had strong minority opinions. There had been a strong minority in 1885 of men who were Zionists, Bernard Felsenthal and others. There was a strong minority of men in 1937 who were anti-Zionists, who went on to found the American Council for Judaism, who were what we call classical reformers, people who still held on to the innocent simplicities of an earlier time. Surely their vote could have been taken and some language which would have satisfied the larger group, the largest group within the conference could have been found and a platform could have been promulgated. What was really being said, I think, by the report or non-report of the platform committee is that we have come to a time in our history, not only we as Jews, but we in the West, where we have lost the sense of community. There's been a breakdown of coherence. As a matter of fact, I think when intellectual historians write the history of the last 30 or 40 years, that's one of the themes that they're going to center in on. Where heretofore there was a large middle, a set of conventional values, of conventional wisdom, which seemed to, there was to which there was general agreement. Oh, there were people with strong arguments on the one hand and on the other, and some mishugoyim on top of it. But by and large, there was a kind of conventional consensus that seemed to form and reshape itself from time to time, but nevertheless to be there. And what seems to have happened in recent years is that we have got very much in our muscle. None of us wants to bend. None of us wants to be flexible. None of us wants to be voted over or voted out. We are unwilling simply to be a minority. After the passage of the 1885 platform, after the passage of the 1937 platform, no one had to take an oath of on the basis of this creed or recant what they had said, which was opposed to it, which would now be declared heretical. This was simply a statement of where the consensus fell at that moment in time. Everyone went on doing what he, in fact, or she, in fact, had been doing until then, but now with an awareness of where the central group within the faith happened to be. What these men were essentially saying is none would bend to the other. They were unwilling to take a vote, and those who might lose in the vote were unwilling to simply allow the publication of a state of the faith document. Each one wanted to hold on to his ism, to his particular set of values, to his sense of the I and what he believed. And if you look at our society, you find this all about. We live at a time when our schools are being attacked as coercive. And what does that mean? That means that public education until the last 20 or 30 years assumed that there was a basic set of values, socialization patterns, a basic language, which should be the conventional, the common language of all who came to the public schools. Now these ideas are looked upon as coercive, as the imposition from above of a set of values. Rather, each group should have its own language in school, should have its own set of values. And though we talk very much about the integration of our schools, in point of fact, even in the integrated schools, we have black studies and Indian studies and Spanish studies and Hebrew studies and white studies. You know, everyone is doing his own thing. Everyone insists that that's the only way it can be done. And whereas, say, in political life, we have had a century or more of a two-party system with broad, coherent, more or less coherent collections of people organized to accommodate to the political process. Now we essentially have a politics based on the charisma of individuals. The parties are becoming less and less significant, and what is more and more significant is the ability of an individual to say the right things in the right language to enough small groups in order to build up a majority which will win an election. There's been a breakdown of coherence throughout the society. None of us want to be imposed on, the kids use the phrase to be dumped on, by the groups who are beyond. And this exists not only between the new ethnic divisions, the new racial divisions, the religious divisions in our society. It exists within these divisions themselves. Every institution is suspect. No one wants to be told. And what is an institution, whether it be a school or a recreational institution or a political institution or a church or a synagogue? It is nothing more than a consensus of a group of people about the way they want to go about a particular activity. But no one wants to bow to that consensus. Some simply hunker down and keep their concerns to themselves. Others, when their concerns are more burning, go off and found their own splinter party, their own chavura, their own little communitarian group. The sense of community has broken down. And the inability of our conference to come up with a state of the faith statement says less about the fact that there may be basic divisions between us. There really aren't. The divisions I suggested to you are not that basic, but suggest rather that each one of us is huddling his sense of self to himself. He's demanding that his way be the way, and he's unwilling to accommodate to another way. Faced with this inability to come up with a platform, the conference, in a sense, lowered its sights and produced what we would call a centenary perspective. A platform is something very solid. You can stand on it. It's written in declarative sentences. A perspective is a rather hazy look out into the future. The language can be equivocal. It can be uncertain, unclear. Sometimes it's deliberately fuzzy because you can't see the shape of what lies beyond the horizon. And they produced a perspective. As I suggested to you, because of its very nature, it's a non-event. It tries to please everybody. I won't bother reading the language to you, but it's a language in which you're right, and you're right, and you're right too. You know the old Jewish story. And because you're right, and you're right, and you're right too, what we have is what we call in our Hebrew tradition a kolbo, a document in which everything is in it, a compendium of all points of view, which is shapeless by the very nature of its principle of organization. Now, what I propose to do at San Francisco is to try and analyze, as far as I can, those cultural themes which have led us to the position, to this moment in time, when we are essentially porcupines with our quills at alert, unwilling to pull them back in and to go along with, to get along with anybody else. We've lost the sense of the importance of coherence and of community. And I think that I'll try and say a number of things. One of them, which is worth pondering, I think, has to do with a word which was coined by Leo Strauss. Leo Strauss was a professor of political thought at the University of Chicago who died just a few years ago. He was born in Europe. He came here in the 1930s. He was one of the seminal figures as a teacher. His interests were in Socrates and Hegel and in some of the interpretation of the various secrets that non-Orthodox thinkers had written into their works during the Age of Faith in a coded sense. He was a fascinating man. And when he used to talk about the emergence of modern society, he would say that modern society can be understood by one term. And the term he chose was privatism. And by privatism, he meant that modern life, modern thought, is dedicated to what John Locke called the inalienable rights of the individual. That you can study modern life as an attempt of the individual to free himself from the trammels, from the authority of church, of king, of guild, of academy, of tradition, of family, of all of the units which up to that time had imposed their will upon him, in a sense been coercive of him. It was an attempt to center the judgmental process in the individual rather than in the institution or body of thought outside of him. Everything now begins with me. I'm going to do what's right in my own eyes. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to make up my own mind. No one's going to tell me what to do. And obviously, a great deal of change and progress has emerged because of the freeing of the individual from the trammels of these old authoritarian groups. But I keep remembering the definition of virtue that Maimonides offered following on Aristotle in his commentary on the saying of the fathers. He said that virtues are dispositions which are midway between two reprehensible extremes. Virtues are dispositions which are midway between two reprehensible extremes. And there is a possibility that we have taken the sense of I, egotism, the grounding of judgment in one's own self so far that we have cut ourselves off from the ability to do what is obviously basic and meaningful in human life, to relate effectively and meaningfully with another individual, with another group, with a group of individuals, with family, with community, and the like. Now, I'm not sure that privatism explains everything in modern life. It certainly doesn't explain the willingness of millions of people to give themselves over to the authority of the man on the white horse, to fascism or to communism. But within the West, particularly within the middle class, the upper middle class in the West, the educated class, particularly among Jews, privatism can be seen. Label something as libertarian, as conducive to freedom, and you will find an instinctive positive response among these groups. Freedom is a hallowed virtue, an idol, if you will. And what we have not examined in the process of the last 10 or 15 or 20 years are the limits of freedom. The fact that only in the meeting is there meaning. The fact that we must always be able to relate in a basic and intimate and effective and meaningful way. Martin Buber said it 30 years ago, that the I is nothing unless it is conjoined effectively to a you. It is in the relationship that we come alive. The integer has no meaning outside of the sum. The individual has no meaning as a loner unless he's part of a social order. I prize freedom, and I prize my own independence of mind. And obviously, if there had been a state of the faith platform, there would have been in it some things with which I would have disagreed, and I would have gone on teaching as I have taught and thinking as I have thought. But is there not a point at which all of us must begin to rethink the value of the I? Is there not a point at which we must begin to rethink the Hillel's old polarity? If I am for myself alone, what am I? But if I am not for myself, who will be for me? I must stand and be myself. And yet I must learn to experiment with and to experience and to involve myself in the group. And only in that tension, in that relationship, can there be meaning for my personal life, and can there be a future for a religious group or for any group. I think we've come to a time when this conventional wisdom, which is called privatism, must be seriously examined. And one of the things that I'm going to suggest at San Francisco is that this would be a theme to which our liberal tradition be devoted. For surely, Reform Judaism or liberal Judaism is something more than every Jew doing that which is right in his own eye. Surely it is tied to tradition. Surely there's a wealth of insight and experience there from which we would be fools not to draw. The fight no longer is for freedom. That fight has been won, at least here. The fight now is for community, for coordination, and for coherence. And that struggle is yet to be undertaken. Amen.